on harmony.
At the same time as their female counterparts celebrating in a nearby building, the men engage in prayers and reciting the Quran, followed by delicious free food, a symbol of the Holy Prophet's largesse. Saeed Pereza, Bolton.
The Silicon Valley of Iran, Paradis Technology Park, is home to heavyweight tech firms, from fintech to medical and robotics companies. Here, at the 20th Paradis Annual Summit, Paradis Park acknowledged the top brands that have made major contributions to the country's economic growth.
We produce mining, drilling, and extraction machinery, including road headers, side dump loaders, conveyors, bolts, as well as junction boxes. Our products are built based on international standards. We're planning to export to other countries, starting from Turkey.
We're producing all of the supplements and medicines that have a high degree of technology based on biotechnology or human medicines, veterinary medicines, and so on.
Located in west of Tehran, Paradis Technology Park was launched in 2001 with the aim of offering financial and consulting support to small enterprises and commercializing their products. Currently, it has 400 companies under its belt, many of which have turned into tech giants.
Inside the park, we try to provide many kind of facilities and services for these companies. Some of them are professional services, including, for example, some kind of consultancies like as legal and financial consultancies, providing some kind of services for them for...
Paradis Technology Park predicts that this year, the total export of products from its firms will hit the $50 million mark.
These companies now are exporting to more than 30 countries all over the world, and the number of products which are exporting now is more than 100 high-tech products. And this is a brilliant achievement for us in this situation, and also according to the sanction, these companies now are exporting to other countries.
With U.S. sanctions still haunting the Iranian economy, the country has in recent years attached greater significance to domestic brands. The government is increasingly supporting companies active in non-oil sectors as part of efforts to reduce its dependence on crude revenues, which have faced a slump in the wake of U.S. sanctions.
Each one of these brands started out as a small startup and later grew to make a name for themselves in the market. Paradis Tech Park says it continues to support knowledge-based companies and help them develop, as it believes this will lead to a more resilient economy that will be safe from the ups and downs of the oil sector. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Green flags reading, "We are here, O Prophet of God," decorated the capital Sana'a to mark Prophet Muhammad's birth. Those who attended said this year's celebration is of high significance, given the perilous times Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world are experiencing. Some participants argued that there is a war being waged against the message of Prophet Muhammad and those who follow him. The leader of Ansarullah, Sayyid Abd al-Malik al-Houthi, also addressed the nation, calling for Islamic unity and adherence to the Holy Book of Quran and the message of Islam in an effort to improve the Muslim world. He condemned those who are in favor of normalizing ties with Israel and deemed them as traitors of Allah and His Messenger. Al-Houthi also called on the West to end their animosity towards God and all of His messengers. The Ansarullah leader also called on the Saudi-led coalition to end their war on Yemen, while also renewing his call to Yemenis to continue their resistance.
I call on the coalition of aggressors to end their war and lift the blockade and to end their occupation of our land. Just as I call on our Yemeni people to continue their resistance against our enemies for as long as their aggression continues. We consider this to be an Islamic duty and the holy war that we must commit to.
The birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad comes 1 week after the ceasefire between Yemen and Saudi Arabia officially ended, without reaching an agreement to end the war. Since then, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has sent numerous warnings to Saudi Arabia and the UAE to end the war and lift the blockade, or else face, quote, unprecedented consequences. While millions of Yemenis take to the streets to commemorate the birth anniversary of God's final messenger, the message being delivered here is that the Maulid is not only a day of celebration, it is also a day of resistance against the decades of Western neocolonialism aimed at dominating Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
Thousands of Muslims have held a gathering in Pakistani capital Islamabad to celebrate the birth anniversary of Islam's holy prophet Muhammad.
The occasion is one of the key festivities on the Islamic calendar and holds a special significance for the Muslims around the world. The same goes for the people of Pakistan, who are always excited about commemorating this day.
The participants in the ceremonies say that the day provides Muslims with a great opportunity to understand the teachings and the message of Prophet Muhammad.
Prophet's teachings are still resonating in the society. This is a time to remember and follow the teachings of our Prophet and his family, who dedicated their lives for the great cause of Islam.
This day reminds us of the message of the Holy Prophet. He teaches us to forget our differences and live in peace and harmony with a sense of brotherhood.
In Islamabad, many of the public and private buildings, as well as streets, markets, and mosques, are decorated with buntings and illuminated to mark the auspicious occasion. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Green flags reading, "We are here, O Prophet of God," decorated the capital Sana'a to mark Prophet Muhammad's birth. Those who attended said this year's celebration is of high significance, given the perilous times Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world are experiencing. Some participants argued that there is a war being waged against the message of Prophet Muhammad and those who follow him.
We are here to send a message to the world and our enemies that our Islamic nation will never abandon our beloved Prophet and that we will always follow his path and the examples of our leaders from the Prophet's household.
The leader of Ansarullah, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, also addressed the nation, calling for Islamic unity and adherence to the holy book of Quran and the message of Islam in an effort to improve the Muslim world. He condemned those who are in favor of normalizing ties with Israel and deemed them as traitors of Allah and His Messenger. Al-Houthi also called on the West to end their animosity towards God and all of His messengers. The Ansarullah leader also called on the Saudi-led coalition to end their war on Yemen, while also renewing his call to Yemenis to continue their resistance. The birth anniversary of Prophet Muhammad comes 1 week after the ceasefire between Yemen and Saudi Arabia officially ended, without reaching an agreement to end the war. Since then, Yemen's Ansarullah movement has sent numerous warnings to Saudi Arabia and the UAE to end the war and lift the blockade, or else face, quote, unprecedented consequences.
While millions of Yemenis take to the streets to commemorate the birth anniversary of God's final messenger, the message being delivered here is that the Maulid is not only a day of celebration, it is also a day of resistance against the decades of Western neocolonialism aimed at dominating Yemen and the rest of the Muslim world. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
U.S. President Joe Biden has signed a new classified policy that limits the country's drone operations and tightens the rules of engagement. This policy will limit drone operations in several countries where the U.S. has carried out many strikes in recent years, including Afghanistan. U.S. drones, however, are still flying in the skies of Afghanistan, and people are worried that deadly strikes could still happen any moment.
Of course, in this case, people are receiving the harsh impacts more than the government. Such attacks create mental conditions for us. We don't feel safe and always feel threatened. When they fly over our sky, they make the days and nights horrific.
Surely the drones make us worry. We know they have special targets, but we have also seen civilians being targeted too. When we hear them flying, we get scared, especially the children.
Back in 2017, the Trump administration replaced old guidelines with a looser set of rules for drone engagement that led to a 330% rise in civilian casualties in Afghanistan. A research by an independent media organization shows that from 2015 to 2020 alone, between 300 to 900 civilians lost their lives to U.S. drone operations. Experts say that even with the new policy adopted, U.S. drones in Afghanistan are still dangerous.
The U.S. government, according to its hegemonic dominance worldwide, is always after fulfilling their national interests. If their national interests require it, drone attacks could take place anyway. According to the policy, the attack permit only goes to a higher authority rather than commanders. Biden would sign the attack permit.
The aforementioned policy requires near certainty that a target is a member of a designated terrorist group and near certainty that no civilians will be killed or injured before pulling the trigger. But it still remains unclear what this near certainty standard means in practice. The precision of U.S. drone attacks in Afghanistan has always been under question. There have been many examples of misguided U.S. strikes. Notably, an attack just before the withdrawal of U.S. forces last year that killed 10 members of a family. People here are still concerned that they might be the next target. Abdullah Hamirzadeh, Kabul.
I'm heading with Donbass militia fighters to a frontline position outside the city of Donetsk. Ukrainian soldiers are only 70 meters away. I'm told not to film the skyline or any prominent markers so as not to give away their positions. The cramped living quarters are dark and dank. A fighter with the call sign Yidra, meaning the otter, gives me a tour.
We live here not in trenches but under concrete. These are destroyed buildings that we've old basements. It is all dug out by hands, down the narrow passageways and understand what it's like to be a miner. We live here, breathe this air. You can't survive artillery any other way. At least you can hide from snipers, but not from artillery. Big caliber artillery, too.
He shows me a picture sent to him by his daughter. I asked him what has motivated him to fight in these conditions for the last 8 years.
Because this is where I live. My mother lives 25 kilometers from here. I speak Russian. My mom and dad speak Russian. I was a miner here. It's my land.
A young fighter, barely 18. The grueling nature of this war is bringing a seamlessly endless wave of young men on both sides to fight. A motivational poster, it reads, Donbass was never made to kneel by anybody, and nobody will be able to do it.
We understand that the USA are ruling this circus. Europe needs to stop being their vassals. America doesn't care about others. Their only way is to be at war. And they build their domestic policy out of conflicts with other countries. In Syria, they played the card of radical Islam. And now they're playing the card of fascism. They need war's blood and cruelty. And they signed Europe up to it, too. They missed only one thing, that Russia will not stop fighting.
While there is raging ethnic hatred of Russians in Ukraine, after interviewing dozens of soldiers and civilians in Donbass, despite the war, I've yet to hear any ethnic hatred of Ukrainians.
We don't blame all Ukrainian people. Ukrainian people are our friends and relatives. Those who study this understand that one-third of Europe are cousins. Ukrainians, Belarusians, Slovaks, Poles, and Slovenians. They're all Slovak people. Ordinary people are not to blame for this. We think they're just corrupted by evil.
Out many Ukrainians who want peace negotiations with Russia, but are scared to speak up. Indeed, President Zelensky was elected in 2019 of war in the East, but the sad truth is set to escalate further. Peace in Ukraine has never looked less likely than it does now. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee, so recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday 5 things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to sanctions, Iran has been a target of Western countries for quite some time, especially the U.S. And now with the most recent protests, which consists of foreign-backed riots, sanctions are raining down on Iran, from Canada's sanctions on Iran's press TV to the IRGC members, to the U.S. and U.K. sanctioning of Iran's police. We ask, does the U.K., or Western countries have the ground to stand on when it comes to human rights or the right to impose sanctions when they are guilty of human rights violations in their own country? And don't their sanctions constitute interference in other countries' affairs? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. He joins us. He's a political analyst from London. Also joining us is Hafsa Kara Mustafa, journalist and political commentator, who also joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. I'd like to first start with you, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, if I may, and ask you about the UK sanctions, where they have sanctioned Iran's police. And at this point, the quick question that comes about is, does the UK really have a leg to stand on when it comes to the issue of human rights, of which it is basing its sanctions on?
Well, certainly not at a time where Julian Assange is rotting in prison, facing what no one really understands what charges, since the charges from the Swedish lady who initially pressed charges against him have been dropped. And obviously he's being maintained in solitary confinement, which is actually a violation of basic human rights. So just on that element alone, I think Britain doesn't have a leg to stand on. But of course, there are so many other details. For instance, war crimes committed by British soldiers, whether in Iraq or Afghanistan, in the way they were treating civilians. So of course, Britain has no leg to stand on. But we're used to seeing Western nations actually lecturing other countries on human rights and on issues such as these, whilst at home or for their own, actually never respecting those very basic human rights that they feel others should abide by.
Shobha Brisby, taking a look at the EU, they have issued a resolution against Iran, and I need to just get justifications from you, and that's why I'm reading off some of the countries or organizations that have leveled sanctions, and in this case, resolution, where it said the resolution criticizes the necessary countermeasures that Iran has taken against the organized acts of violence. Why does the EU feel that it has to come into the picture as a whole and issue a resolution against Iran?
Hello, good evening, Kava. Obviously, we saw recently one of the Swedish MEP in Brussels cutting her hair. So tonight, I'll be cutting the tie to show that this is the symbol of oppression, which everyone should take off their ties if they want to be part of the resistance movement. Now, coming back to your question, why EU at this time? As our fellow colleague from London quite rightly pointed out, that not only there's hypocrisy and double standards on part of the Britain, but the whole of the European Union, from tiny countries like Lithuania, Estonia, and others in the Baltic and other countries in Europe, they quite often work in cahoots with Washington to put pressure on Iran. As you can remember, even Iran is the country for the last 42 years, the West has been at war with Iran in one form or another, whether it was the eight-year war inflicted on Iran via Saddam in Iraq, or sanctions being applied, or nuclear scientists being assassinated, all kinds of conspiracies and intrigue has been created for the last 42 years. If there were any other nation other than Iran, it would have succumbed by now. The only reason why all these measures are being applied to Iran is that because it does not support the Zionist entity in West Asia. Tomorrow, if the government and the leadership in Iran decides to recognize Israel, then hunky-dory, there is no human rights issue. There are no problems with Iran. Iran would be in the good books of the West. Uh-huh. So the reality is that it's the support for the Palestinians and being part of the resistance and really not recognizing the Zionist state that has created the problem for Iran for the last 42 years. Not pitifully of the death of this particular young lady. That just a decoy to hoodwink the world into thinking that West is on the side of the human rights.
Sympathize strongly with the passing away of the woman is what Iran's president has said. Iran's leader has said that also, that it was a sad thing, Hafsatkar Mustafa. But this is the statement that we continue to hear. We will continue to work with our partners to hold Iranian officials accountable for gross human rights violations. Keep hearing that over and over again, and mostly this comes from the U.S. Is this a line by the U.S. to tell its partners that you should go with the line that we're telling you or asking you so we can all appear as a united front against Iran? Is that what it's trying to do here?
Well, I think that at this particular moment in time, I think what the EU and America are trying to do is push Iran in a corner because it's a major gas producer, and they want to make sure that Iran will succumb and will adhere to whatever conditions that are imposed by Western powers when it comes to trading with Iran. So push it in a corner in order for Iran to then be far more compliant. I'd have to say, it's not just about Israel, because the Shah was actually recognized Israel, and at the last minute he was dropped by the West. So Israel is inevitably an element of why the West is constantly against Iran, but it's also a way of maintaining it is a resistance country that hasn't complied in any way to any Western pressure. But it's also the way of keeping pressure because it's a major oil and gas producer, and therefore it's a way of making sure that when you play hot and cold with a country like Iran, you can manage to force it to comply, which it doesn't. Can I just add also that just before the COVID pandemic started, for instance, France had faced major human rights violation issues when it shot and when it maimed scores and hundreds of protesters during the Yellow Vest movement that lasted almost a year, and no sanctions were ever imposed on it, despite major evidence that the police were literally shooting to maim the protesters. So we can see constantly the double standards when it comes to countries such as Iran. And of course, it is basically designed to weaken these countries and to force them to accept whatever terms and conditions is imposed on them in order to allow them to trade more easily.
Iran has come out and said that the internal issue of the Islamic Republic is related to the governments and the nation of Iran. Shabbi Rizvi, we will not allow any country to interfere in the internal affairs of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Where do you think that line was crossed when it came to the reaction by, let's say, the UK or the US or the EU or Germany for that matter?
Well, as I said, the line was crossed when the advent of the Islamic Revolution occurred back 42 years ago. Since then, there have been all kinds of maneuvers that have been used by the West to continuously try to weaken Iran. But the reality is that no matter what methods they use, no matter what sort of technology, I mean, recently, the cyber attacks that have been taking place in Iran is another aspect, plus the use of the social media that is occurring to ignite certain elements of the public to come out on the streets. And the reality is that, like the sister said, that, you know, what happened in France with the yellow vest. But the reality is that if you look at the USA, I think the latest figure before coming on to this interview I was looking at, during this year, 1,117 people have been killed in police custody in the USA. So really, you know, how does America and the West have any leg to stand on when they talk about brutality by the Iranian government, when they are not only brutal and commit atrocities on other countries, but they also do the same to their own people if they're standing against, you know. And the thing is, the demonstrations that take place in the West are not really to change the government, not to change the political system. People are usually asking for their basic rights. For instance, over the weekend in UK, there were demonstrations up and down the country in support of, you know, the against cost of living, the price of energy. And again, over the weekend, there were demonstrations in Germany, in Holland, in Italy, all over the place, with the cost of living crisis that is facing the West. So when there are demonstrations just for basic needs, those demonstrators are, in a way, beaten up, and all kinds of issues are used. I just want to remind your audience and sort of recap back here in 10 years ago, there were demonstrations in London virtually over the weekend in many, many cities. What happened at that time, hundreds and thousands of people were arrested and got a criminal record. The courts sort of sat overnight to send people into prison. It was a riotous situation. And again, people were demanding, you know, basic rights, not demanding the change of government. If, for example, if the demonstrators did come out in Paris, London, or New York, demanding the change of government, then I can see very easily when people were killed at Kent University 60 years ago, demonstrating against Vietnam War. So there's a whole litany of human rights abuses by the West in their own countries against their own people for decades.
Okay, Shabir Rizvi, House of Karim Mustafa, mentions how the media encourages, Shabir Rizvi, correct me if I'm wrong, for people to come out and protest. So usually when they do that, in many instances, if not almost all instances, they are putting that in the context of a video where people are actually vandalizing or setting something on fire. So that's, in a sense, encouraging to incite violence. Now, at the same time, we are looking at the double standards at play here, which I'm trying to understand how they think they can get away with it. When you have, for example, what happened in the protests in London a few weeks back at the Iranian embassy, where protesters, many of them were Iranians, actually clashed with the police in London. Then the Met said, we got to go after them. These people, because some got away, I guess. The Iranians, that is. And there was some pictures that were plastered, kind of like a manhunt. I'm not too sure if they got them yet or not. That approach is okay for London, but not in Iran. In Iran, come out, protest, violence, etc. What do you think about the way that the UK is displaying itself there?
Well, again, I mean, it's been very hypocritical, but it always is. Just to pick up on the other panelists' point, again, there were in 2010, in the harsh winter, which is one of the coldest winters on record, students came out to protest against tuition fees, and the police introduced a method called kettling, which meant that they were kept standing still for 6-7 hours in -4 degrees temperatures, and they couldn't move. And those who tried to move were arrested and were given exemplary sentences up to 4 years for simply attempting to leave the ring and to leave this sort of kettling method. So the brutality, police brutality, whenever anyone takes to the street to protest, even for basic things such as banning tuition fees, is actually repressed in the most violent ways. And yet here you have people actually encouraging Iranians to go out and to break and to commit violent crimes, which is, again, I mean, the hypocrisy is staggering, but we're so used to it. I think people have just become accustomed to it and no longer know what to say. But I think public opinion is very is not as on board as it used to be. I'd love to say that overall people are seeing through the propaganda, Western propaganda. They're not. But many do realize that there is a double standard. Many have also pointed out the fact that in France, women, for instance, are not allowed to wear the hijab, and no one said anything about the basic human rights of these women. When you see French women sort of cutting their hair as a symbol to support their the Iranian women, knowing, can I add, that the current Home Secretary, the Interior Minister of France, has been accused by four different women of rape. So when a French woman goes to the police station to complain that she's been a victim of a sexual assault, the boss of the police officers has actually himself been accused of rape by four different women. So this is the absolute comical scenario, had it not had such dangerous consequences, that we're currently living. We're living in times of absurdity, and no one can see through it.
Well, the thing that is very alarming here is the way that the approach is being used by certain governments, which is now somewhat coming to light, that there may be political, perhaps, intentions. This is another side to this whole saga, if you may call it, Shabir Rizvi, where you've had certain politicians come out and say, I believe it was the UK Foreign Secretary that came out and said this, that Iran should behave. Iran should not deal with the protests violently, because if it wants, for example, for there to be, and Iran should not go after the nuclear bomb, all within one context, alluding to the fact that Iran should stop this, and along with that, perhaps it might find a way for this JCPOA revival sanctions removal talks to happen, if you know what I'm getting at with this. So are we looking at governments trying to somewhat push Iran, using the protest as a means to get back or to come into the deal that has been worked on for quite some time?
Well, look, if you want me to address the issue of JCPOA, I think that's not really quite fundamental. Whether the JCPOA comes to an agreement or not, that's not an issue. But I think whether it's the UK Foreign Secretary, Mr. Cleverly, or any other Western leader, whenever they get on their pulpit and start preaching to a nation like Iran on human rights abuse, on XYZ, I think they should really look closer home and really try to sort of implement policies which would be in favor of the ordinary people here. You know, our previous Home Secretary, Priti Patel, passed legislation where even demonstrating would become illegal in the UK. And the current Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, is even sort of extraordinary trying to implement policies of all kinds, whereby they want to send, people coming to UK as asylum seekers to Rwanda. So all kinds of different human rights abuses are taking place in the United Kingdom and most of the European countries. So really, at the end of the day, I think all the nations, all the sort of Western nations, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, European Union, and USA really should analyze what they are doing themselves. But I dare say, because the reality is that they feel that they are right, they have the arrogance to continue on the same policy, and really they suffer from hubris, to use a phrase which is often used to describe this kind of a situation, when the people who continually speak a lie start believing that lie and think that they are taking the right path. But the reality is that, as our other guest speaker was saying, that I think at least some people, even in the West, are realizing the hypocrisy of their own governments. And I think the cost of living crisis and what's happening with Ukraine will perhaps remove the veils from the eyes of the people, right, who still feel that the West is always right.
I'm going to reflect on a statement made by a former CIA official, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, if I may, to get your reaction on this, because this relates to what Iran's leader has said. where Bruce Riddell, who was a former CIA official, said there's little doubt that there is a covert war that's underway against Iran, and there are at least two players in it. It's the U.S. and Israel. How much do you think that this statement made by the Bruce Riddell actually applies maybe to what is going on here? Because we know, obviously, in terms of Israel and also in terms of the U.S., this has been going on for quite some time against Iran.
I mean, surprisingly honest coming from a CIA source. But again, I mean, if it's a CIA, he obviously knows what he's talking about. And it's true. Since the Iranian Revolution back in 1979, Iran has been in the firing line of both America and Israel. And it's the only country that has been consistently opposed to any normalization with Israel, has closed the former Israeli embassy, replaced it with a Palestinian embassy. So it's constantly inflicting humiliation upon humiliation on Israel. And Israel is not accepting this lightly. So, you know, the more Iran resists, the more Israel will apply pressure. And unfortunately, of course, as with many other countries, you have, what Malcolm X refers to as the house slaves, the people who actually are within, inside, and who serve foreign interests. And I think that could be a danger for Iran. But of course, I think that when push comes to shove, Iranians have always showed to rally amongst each other and in support of their government, and always rally against foreign enemies because they know that they're a target. And therefore, even though I think things look worrying at this very moment, if anything, I suspect that when the worst comes to pass, actually Iran will come out of this stronger. And it will come out of this stronger. Why? Because, of course, Europe is about to face a wave of civil unrest over the cost of living crisis. And I think, ironically, it will be the opportunity for many Iranian Twitters and people on social media to then encourage their Western counterparts to do what they're currently doing to Iranian protesters.
Well, here's a good point. And this is really sad, but the differentiation needs to be mentioned again, Shebi Rizvi, and that is the fact that if you had, which I'm sure there were people who were protesting when this protest first broke out, that even though it was not related in their eyes when they came out to protest to the unfortunate death of that young woman, but they were protesting because they were perhaps economically were not privileged. They had financial, perhaps, gripes that were plaguing their daily lives. But this protest got stolen once violence kicked in and once there was rioting and once there were destruction of property, of which that particular sect of the protesters, that's not what they obviously wanted to promote, to have their voices heard. How do you think, I mean, this is speculation maybe, but how do you think that happened where that division all of a sudden appeared and then the ones that were protesting peacefully went out of the picture, and now it's just people who want to vandalize in a sense. Not all of them still, but a majority of them.
Well, look, at the end of the day, in every country there are economic issues, and particularly with Iran, when it has been sanctioned for the last 42 years, there will, of course, be issues which would affect a significant number of people. But there are ways of protesting, and also, as President Rouhani has quite rightly pointed out, that demonstrations are permitted in Iran, but violence of this type, killing of the policemen, destruction of property, burning of police cars, in any country, this will not be acceptable. So why should it be acceptable in Iran? But also you must remember, Kaveh, is that quite often there is a particular segment in each city, whether it's in London, New York, or Washington, or Tehran. There's a richer part of a city and perhaps not that well off. Of course, the richer part of any city are not the barometer of any nation. For example, in London, if you came and asked someone living in Hampstead or Kensington about cost of living crisis, sure, they will have no idea. Similarly, in Iran, if someone living in sort of expensive parts of Tehran will not understand that.
Thank you. I'm sorry we're first out of time. Do appreciate that, though. Shebi Rizvi, political analyst. Hazakar Mustafa, pleasure, journalist and political commentator, both from London. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahveh and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
U.S. President Joe Biden last week slammed two Republican senators for proposing to end Social Security and Medicare as we know it. First, President Biden renewed his attacks on Florida's Rick Scott and has called for all government programs, including Social Security and Medicare, to be reapproved every 5 years. The president then ripped Wisconsin's Ron Johnson for recently proposing a vote each year to determine if Social Security and Medicare would be funded. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. MSNBC has more on this story. Republican Senator from Florida Rick Scott, chair of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, writes in his 11-point plan to rescue America, "If a law is worth keeping, Congress can pass it again. That means if our notoriously gridlocked Congress couldn't agree on the terms of what Social Security and Medicare should look like every 5 years, those programs would end." In his remarks about Senator Ron Johnson, President Biden said, "As my mother would say, God love him." Before you roll your eyes and say that Republicans won't really end those two beloved federal programs, remember how many of us dismissed the GOP when for years they vowed to overturn Roe v. Wade. Many viewed their words as simply red meat for their base. It wasn't. We need to admit that GOP leaders mean what they say. They will doggedly work towards their goal of dismantling Social Security and Medicare, especially if they regain control of Congress and the White House. Here's the alarming truth. These calls to end Social Security and Medicare as they are administered are not new. Democrat Franklin Roosevelt signed the Social Security program into law in 1935. And Democrat Lyndon B. Johnson signed Medicare into existence in 1965. For decades, Republicans have been saying they are coming for these programs, two of the Democratic Party's proudest achievements. In fact, many Republicans actively campaign against Medicare. George H.W. Bush, who was running for U.S. Senate in 1964, called Medicare socialized medicine. A few years before that, Ronald Reagan had claimed that Medicare would lead to Americans telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America when men were free. In the recent political era, however, the GOP hasn't just spoken negatively about the programs, but used their power to try to undermine them. In 1994, when Republicans, led by Newt Gingrich of Georgia, took control of the House for the first time in 40 years, one of their top priorities was gutting Medicare. And the next year, with Republicans in control of the House and the Senate, they voted to cut $270 billion in Medicare funding to finance a tax cut that would primarily benefit upper-income taxpayers. Experts said the budget cut would push 500,000 seniors into poverty. And President Bill Clinton, who vetoed the measure, accused the Republicans of trying to eviscerate the health system for older Americans. After Donald Trump was elected president in 2016, then-Speaker of the House, GOP Representative Paul Ryan, re-upped his plan to change Medicare into something unrecognizable. Instead of Medicare guaranteeing coverage for those over the age of 65, Paul Ryan wanted to create, in essence, a voucher program where Americans would have subsidies to buy private health insurance. The result would have been the shrinking of Medicare and seniors covering more of their medical bills. In response, the head of the AARP slammed Paul Ryan's proposal as a clear downgrade of the Medicare benefits people have earned throughout their working lives, adding that seniors will be asked to bear more risk at greater personal cost. The GOP was also opposed to Social Security right from the start. Before Social Security was enacted, millions of seniors who weren't able to work simply had no income, ending up in poor houses or on the street. But in 1935, Republican Representative John Tabor of New York said it was designed to prevent business recovery, to enslave workers, and to prevent any possibility of the employers providing work for the people. The website politico.com has more on the same story. For two decades, campaign after campaign, Republican politicians have floated the idea of privatizing government entitlement programs, including Social Security and Medicare. And campaign after campaign, from Paul Ryan to George W. Bush, it's been a loser. But for some reason, they keep trying. The latest is Don Bolduc, New Hampshire's GOP Senate nominee, who advocated privatizing Medicare during a campaign town hall meeting in early August, according to a recording of the event obtained by Politico. Don Bolduc's comments came in response to a woman who said she was a nurse and complained about Medicare and Medicaid, arguing they were worsening outcomes for elderly patients and hamstringing medical professionals. Don Bolduc volunteered that he frequently speaks about how major reform is necessary for the government-sponsored health insurance programs for seniors and people with low incomes. "The privatization is hugely important," the retired Army general told the audience in the town of Pembroke on 2nd of August. "Getting government out of it, getting government money with strings attached out of it." In a statement, Don Bolduc spokesperson Jimmy Thompson walks back Bolduc's comments, saying the candidate now opposes privatizing Medicare, Medicaid and Social Security. Having served 10 tours of combat in Afghanistan, General Bolduc relies on his health care from the Veterans Association, Thompson said in an email. He knows firsthand how important its services are to veterans, and he believes that every American who's eligible should be able to rely on the benefits they have paid into, including Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. Jimmy Thompson added that Bolduc will oppose any effort to privatize these programs. "Privatizing government entitlement programs has long been a policy goal for some segments of the Republican Party, who worry about the federal deficit and the growing share of the federal budget those programs take up. But they're hugely popular with voters who plan their retirements around those benefits. And in recent years, particularly during the administration of Donald Trump, fiscal conservatives and deficit hawks have seen their issues relegated to the back burner, while the party focused its messaging on hot-button social issues like immigration, crime and abortion. Still, the idea hasn't totally left the GOP ecosystem, despite the idea's unpopularity and Democrats' use of the issue in campaign advertisements. Some Republicans have continued to advocate for privatizing entitlement programs as a government cost-saving measure, arguing that the programs will become insolvent in a matter of years and may not be guaranteed for future generations.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.